You know, we're walking around as the embodiment of millions of years of evolutionary intelligence that's kind of accrued. But we have this, I guess they call that the spotlight awareness, where our brains are focusing in on this narrow bandwidth to keep us safe, you know, at the expense of all this other much, much wider strata of information that we're aware of at a deeper level, but not perceiving consciously. But to me, that's where all the juicy stuff really lives. And as a musician myself, that's where the muse speaks. And anytime we try to bring forth something new in the world, whether it's a new song or a business idea or an email to a new client, you know, we're speaking from that blank slate of possibility and potentiality.
And welcome to Curious Ones podcast by Andara. I'm Yael Ginsberg, the host of the podcast, a yoga and meditation teacher and philosophy lover. Each week, you will hear eye-opening interviews with the different teachers of the Andara Yoga Institute, located in beautiful Baja, Mexico, along with other teachers that pass through here. This life-changing knowledge shared through authentic, heartfelt communication will help you live a happier, more fulfilled, and connected life. Let's dive in. Hello, welcome back to Curious Ones podcast by Andara. I'm Yael Ginsberg, and today I have the incredible Girish with me.
Thanks, Yael.
Girish is an internationally touring music artist, teacher, and author of the book Music and Mantras. He has online courses, retreats all over the world, and about 60,000 monthly listeners on Spotify. So definitely go check that out. Welcome to the podcast, Girish.
Thank you so much. Yeah, what a treat to like hang out and get to connect in paradise. Hopefully all that energy is coming right through your devices to feel like the beautiful space that you're kind of co-creating here, and also where we're sitting here in on the Baja Peninsula in Mexico, the sacred space of Yandara. It's just incredible.
Yeah, you walk in here and it's like everything else stays behind.
Yeah, amazing. You know, we're so used to that other example of the influence of a space, unfortunately. You know, you walk in and you're having to like do these practices, do this work to kind of keep yourself elevated. But in a space like this, the elevation, the connection, the embodiment is what this place is kind of resonating. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like you just become entrained to it, you know?
Yeah. I think we don't really realize how affected we are by the energy of the space that we're in, and we might even take it like personally in the way that,
like, it's our fault.
Yeah, like, yeah. Why is my energy not good, not realizing how sensitive we are to what is around us?
There's this word in Sanskrit that you know, it is exactly what you're talking about. It's tan matra, you know, and it means like the subtle influence, the subtle vibration of a place. So like if you walk into, like I did yesterday, the Cabo airport, like that's one vibe.
Yeah.
And then you walk into a temple in India and then you can feel the beneficial tanmatras, you know, the subtle energies. And in a sense, we're also engines of those tanmatras, those, and matra means mother. Mm-hmm. And so it's the idea of these sort of the influences that give birth, the energetic influences that create what we see reflected in the world around us, you know. So there are physical spaces like Yandara that hold these beautiful, graceful, elegant tanmatras or subtle vibrations. but that inspire us to then become the embodiments of those higher vibrations so that we bring those beneficent energies into a space. We become the temple, like the walking temple, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I always find it so beautiful and inspiring to think that when we work on our own personal practice mm-hmm. and take the time to cultivate our own energy mm-hmm. in a way that is beneficial to us and to those around us, that really it does have an effect on our surroundings. And yeah. I always say that to people who are just starting in the yoga practice, mm-hmm. that there is such a bigger effect to our own personal practice mm-hmm. than what we realize that there is, how yeah. connected we are and how yeah. much of an effect that has on the collective consciousness that, mm-hmm. you know, in bigger cities and surroundings yeah. might be very different than what we experience, let's say, here at Yandara.
Exactly. It's so, so true. And I feel like it reflects our interconnectedness, and it also kind of gets us outside of our own fixation on our little story mm-hmm. to feel that.
Definitely. And I think it also gives us kind of hope.
Yeah.
You know, because when you... It could be discouraging to think, well, I'm working on this, but so many people aren't.
Right.
So what's the effect of it?
Yeah, and I'm alone and disconnected. And that's the story. That's where the sort of momentum of the world story seems to be. But it's not a true story. Mm. And ultimately, there are no true stories, like, you know, in terms of anything we can conceive of. The truth, as I understand it, is a direct experience, you know, and tuning into that sense, that intuition of like connectedness, you know, gives us that experience and gives us that hope that you were talking about. So you don't feel disconnected and hopeless in the midst of all of it. And even it doesn't mean that like the world's going to suddenly be perfect and everything's going to go the way you think. Like, what if the process of evolution includes messiness and shit going wrong all the time? Like I've heard the analogy of like, you know, the process of evolution is like a baby in a birth canal. Like, the baby can't possibly know what this process is that it's in. Mm. And yet, the most difficult birth, as I've heard it explained, is the birth of a stillborn child for many reasons, the first one of which is that the baby is not responding as it's moving through the birth canal and adjusting and shifting intuitively. Mm-hmm. And yet that's that intuitive, like adjusting and responding to life in our case, or in the baby's case, to the pressures and movements of that life birth process assists the evolutionary flow. It's not necessarily comfortable, and it certainly isn't something we can understand with our minds any more than the baby can. And yet, if we don't move and respond in a way that we feel intuitively is right for us, we're in a way fighting against the evolutionary energies, even if they're uncomfortable.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. That's something that I'm thinking about a lot recently, about the role of intuition really in the guidance of our life. So maybe you can speak a little bit about how you see the role of our intuition. What is intuition in your perception? Mm-hmm. And how do you connect to your intuition maybe?
Hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting to me, because in a way, I feel like the only real knowledge is intuitional, like, or at least you could say the only real wisdom is intuitional, because everything else is limited. You know, I think of intuitive wisdom as that directly experienced thing versus something that we kind of render in our heads. And it's just like, you know, falling in love with a person or something. if you were to try to, you know, describe what is that love, you know, and try to put it into 20 words, like you could never do that. It's something that you feel, that you intuit, that you just know in your body, in your heart. And to me, that intuition is like a living knowledge, a living wisdom that is not bound by like reason or even direct, you know, something you can reach out and touch. You know, intuition doesn't make sense a lot of the time. And yet it's somehow the voice of, you know, we're walking around as the embodiment of millions of years of evolutionary intelligence that's kind of accrued. We're like the living embodiments of that evolutionary inheritance. But we have this, I guess they call that the spotlight awareness, where our brains are focusing in on this narrow bandwidth to keep us safe, you know, at the expense of all this other much, much wider strata of information that we're aware of at a deeper level, but not perceiving consciously. And to me, intuition gets at that other wider bandwidth of deeper, maybe sub or unconscious information that is present in our field of consciousness, but we can't necessarily put our finger on it directly. But to me, that's where all the juicy stuff really lives. And as a musician myself, that's where the muse speaks. And anytime we try to bring forth something new in the world, whether it's a new song or a business idea or an email to a new client, you know, we're speaking from that blank slate of possibility and potentiality. And there's no script, you know, it just emerges from that place of flow, of grace. And the reason I think it's so important is because that artificially held sense of like me, of individuality, acts kind of like a filter and a block to that free flow. And what the little bit that I understand about the creative process is that creativity, as they've beautifully embodied in the Hindu iconography, creativity, the arts, innovation, is synonymous with flow, which is why Saraswati means she of abundant waters. Mm-hmm. To flow with life, with creativity, with abundance, with vitality, is to not obstruct the flow of life just as it is. If we're in a place of thinking, this isn't what I wanted, this isn't what I expected, which is every day of our fucking lives, then we're fighting the river, we're putting up these dams. And it's not to say that we just let everything fall to pieces and we don't rise to our intentions, but it's the difference between like fighting the river and riding it. You know, and it's just physics. Mm-hmm. And intuition is that place where the river is flowing underneath it all, and it doesn't necessarily make sense, or maybe it's even like we can't even understand it, you know, like for me, in my experience, taking the leap from being a professional musician as a drummer, as a tabla player who played with these amazing artists in the chant genre, people like Krishna Das and Sanatam Kaur and Wah and all these amazing artists. I had never really sung before, although I was a monk and I practiced mantra in a monastery and all that. I never imagined that I would become a singer, but this intuition that spoke louder and louder in my heart told me that I would not live a happy life unless I sang.
Wow.
And that was a completely unreasonable thing to do from my perspective, from the perspective of the limited self that thought it knew who I was. Yeah. And each of us are in that place where intuition is saying something that is true and that is accurate, but we can't see that clarity necessarily from the perspective of identification at this more limited level.
Yes, and I think it's sometimes also like maybe you know what you need to do, but how to do it isn't clear.
Exactly.
And that is where we stop.
Yeah, and I think one tool to diffuse that obstacle is to somehow take the charge out of that moment of feeling deflated by not knowing the linear steps. Because it's not necessarily our job to know the linear steps. If we like kind of punish ourselves psychically and emotionally by saying like, well, you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You don't know how to become an author, how to become a singer, how to become a teacher, how to do these things that your heart is saying that you should do. And so then you judge that. We could choose to judge that and use that kind of as an excuse or a cover. But if we can diffuse that moment right there and say that not knowing the linear steps is not a disqualifying state of being, mm-hmm. then the energy can flow and it can be okay. We can stay in the not knowing. And so like if you look at some of the greatest artists, the people that I love and revere the most, they talk about that process where the uncertainty is part of the process, you know. I've even heard like great songwriters, like people like Paul Simon, you know, who write these amazing lyrics that I've always like admired and been amazed by. And he says things like, I often don't know what the song is about until it's done. And sometimes even after it's done, I don't know what it's about. And everybody who listens to the song has their own interpretation and meaning of what it is, and yet they are having this artistic, aesthetic, spiritual, energetic experience. And that is a kind of a metaphor for our lives. It's like, I don't know why I'm inspired to do a podcast. I don't know why I'm inspired to become a chef. You know, I don't know why I'm inspired to start a family with this man. You know, like whatever it is, it's like our heart is speaking to us, and yet something, there's a grace that can emerge in that, in spite of the uncertainty. And I feel like this whole last chapter of our collective experience with the pandemic has been especially about getting more and more comfortable with that uncertainty and that vulnerability, and letting go of the old psychic and organizational structures that used to give us a sense of security, and getting more and more comfortable with the free fall of it all.
Definitely. I think you mentioned that you brought it up so beautifully within the creative process of, let's say, making a artistic kind of creation. And you also said, but this can be applied to starting a business or I forget the different examples that you gave. But for me, like I take it to business because when you think about making any sort of creation, it can also be like something within your family or relationships that you would like to create. There can be this knowing of what should be. And then you spoke about becoming comfortable with the uncertainty, with the unknown. And I think that is really something that we have to start to realize, that it's not going to be clear. It's not going to be certain. It's not going to be maybe even comfortable. But that is the only way for us to allow the creation to not resist it, but let it kind of flow. So how do you, what is the internal talk that you have in spaces like this when you know something needs to come out, but don't quite know how to start?
Yeah, I feel like I could answer that from a musical perspective because it's a perfect metaphor and it works whether or not we are musicians or technically artists, because as you were just saying so beautifully, to live is to be a creative, because by definition, in our very lives, we are artists creating this life.
Yes.
With our words, with our actions, with our feelings, you know, with our hearts. And the method for me is, have you ever heard of Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way?
I have.
And she has this practice called morning pages. Mm-hmm. And when I first set on this path of not being a drummer, support musician, working in the studio with all these amazing artists and beginning to write my own songs, I turned to that resource as an ally in the creative journey. The morning pages is a practice of writing three longhand full notebook pages, 8.5 by 11, stream of consciousness without stopping, no edits. And you exercise that free flow muscle. In the studio or when I'm with an instrument writing a song, the way that I work with that, getting more and more comfortable with that uncertainty that you're asking about, is I agree with myself as best I can to quiet the voice of judgment and expectation. So as a specific example, if I sit down, I find most of the time my hands just, and I was not really trained as a keyboard player or a piano player. I'm totally self-taught on most instruments. But I sit down at the keyboard and I don't even really look. I just, my hands plop down and I just feel.
Wow.
And then if a chord comes, I'll look and see and kind of reverse engineer, kind of out of the corner of my eye. If I'm needing another step, like, okay, I see I'm in A flat. So what else might work? But I don't think about it too much. And here's where this method comes into play. The guidance, the intuition, and then on the other hand, the judgment and the expectation are inversely related. When that flow comes through, I'm not allowed to say, yeah, but this doesn't sound like a Gurbish song. I'm not allowed to say, I respond what into the intuition and what grace and what guidance feels like to me is like, yes. A whole body, yes. And this is like exciting. There's energy in it. That's where it stops. Because over that line where it's like, yes, but shouldn't it be more like this or like that? I didn't expect it to be like this. Mm-hmm. Those two things, that's editing. That's trying to impose that tiny little narrow spotlight consciousness, which is like 3%, 5% of the fullness of our consciousness over the whole vastness of consciousness.
Yeah.
There's no point in doing that.
Yeah.
It's like driving a car in first gear. You're going to take forever to get to your destination. You need to just open it out. And to me, every time I do that, and it's a work in progress. I mean, I've made like 7 albums and I've written a book on this stuff. And every time I sit down, it's vulnerable. It's a leap of faith. And it's raw, and it seems impossible. Like, you know, it's not easy. Life is not easy. It's not necessarily comfortable. And yet, to the degree that I can become comfortable with the discomfort, then grace is able to carry a little bit more of the load. Mm-hmm. And grace is able to show herself more and more fully. And I feel like even if steps 1 through 39 are like beautiful and yet don't make any fucking sense, at step 40, you're like, I'm here at this place that I've been wanting to get to. Mm. But you don't get to that place where you're like, you intuited, like, I really wanted to get to this, without being willing to take these blind, seemingly blind steps.
They're blind.
Yeah.
They're blind completely.
Yeah.
I love what you said, because that is such an accurate description of my personal experience. Mm-hmm. Because you might have an idea of where you want to get. Mm. And then I think maybe it's even the natural thing of the mind to kind of make a image of how you're going to get there, mm-hmm. or how it's supposed to look. And rarely it actually looks the way that you think it's going mm-hmm. to look, but mm-hmm. you end up getting to the place that you want it to.
Right.
And I really love that you said that it's just this process of reminding ourselves over and over mm-hmm. of letting go of this perceptions of how it's supposed to look. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I feel it as a softening of letting trust, of trusting whatever needs to come out by being connected to this feeling.
And loving ourselves as we are, which is hard work. And that's why I love singing in mantra so much, because the voice is this beautiful conduit from the inside to the outside. And then it goes the other way. You can take an affirmation or an intention or a mantra with the intention of healing, of awakening, of abundance. You can take that intention and direct it inside too. So it's this kind of shamanic tool that goes both ways. And as we're doing that practice, if we can accept the messiness, the imperfect perfection of it, in a granular embodied way, we are loving ourselves, mm-hmm. word by word, song by song, chant by chant. Loving kindness practice on the purely mental, emotional level is beautiful and a time-honored tradition. And yet, if you add the voice to it, it's granular. It's like in our cells. And your voice is reflecting back to you how you're doing with the practice. Because there's this great book called The Body Keeps the Score, mm-hmm. that's all about how we embody trauma. And even if we don't remember the trauma, our body does.
Yeah.
And we're living imprints of that, those limitations, those scarring experiences in our emotional bodies, in our energetic bodies, and in our physical bodies. And singing gives voice literally to the body's experience and stories. Mm. Not just in the words we're saying, but in the sound and the feeling, the somatic experience of how it feels to sing. And you can have the experience of like, oh shit, my voice sounds terrible and I should just shut up. I should never sing another word, which is a story that the world is sometimes often telling us, you know?
Yeah.
And we're often telling ourselves. And this is not about ego or performance or entertainment. It's about vulnerable, intimate, real self-love and self-care by allowing ourselves to be, to express through our voice, not with the loudest voice in the room, not to stand above or to put down, but to just accept and to receive as we are. To me, the real rasa, the real juice of chanting, yes, on the one hand, the power of the mantra and the lineage and the tradition and all of that beautiful grace, but this radical act of loving ourselves just as we are through the sound of our one-of-a-kind voice. Mm. Those are the two wings of the bird to me in this practice of chanting that make it the most effective tool for transformation and healing that I know.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your practice this morning. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something that really caught my ear, that you guided us to sing not as a form of performance or mm-hmm. entertainment, but just for the sacredness of the music, or mm-hmm. maybe you can say that as the way that you said it, because it was a little different.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was that. It was, what if we could disentangle the act of singing from showmanship or performance, yeah. that sort of whole American Idol voice reality, which is a beautiful thing, you know, and yet if it raises a very select few up at the cost of putting the rest of us and excluding the rest of us. If you go to a wedding in India or go to an Indian wedding, you know, wherever you happen to be, which is something that I experienced, everyone sings. If you go to that big party that they have for the bride that goes on, you know, the Indian wedding lasts for days and days and days, and they celebrate and they sing, and everyone is singing. The grandmothers, the kids, they're all singing and they're banging drums. And it's beautiful. It's not necessarily pretty from a musical standpoint. That's not the point. Mm. And it's interesting because in my book, Music and Mantras, I'm looking at some of the science. I wanted to like get at the evidence-based kind of depth of this practice of chanting and kind of set it apart as an offering for people who maybe haven't been introduced to the bhakti world or to the yoga world. Like, why should I sing at all, much less sing mantras? And it's amazing now that there's all this research about singing as a health and wellness practice. And it turns out that those health and wellness benefits, which are huge for the cardiovascular system, for the pulmonary system, for our neurological systems, it's incredible, along with this overarching sense of feeling of connection. Mm-hmm. When we sing, the body rewards that by releasing oxytocin, which is something that women release when they're breastfeeding. Wow. And men release at the moment of orgasm. It's a bonding hormone, and it's happening when we mm-hmm. sing. So it gives us that sense of belonging, which, if the pandemic taught us nothing else, is that a sense of connection is as essential as water. We need that.
Yeah.
And all these benefits come through singing, and this is the point, whether or not we're very good at it. And this is based on scientific research, and they look at it in a lab, and they looked at professional singers, and they looked at complete amateurs. In fact, these people were homeless on the streets of England, and they brought them in and fed them, and they had them participate in this study. Their test results were higher than the professional singers.
Why do you think that was?
Maybe because the professional singers were more in their heads about the quote-unquote accuracy or musicality of their performance. And the homeless people were like, oh my God, thank you, like, for welcoming me in. Mm. They were able to really lean into singing as an act of connection and bonding.
Yeah.
And it tells us that we have permission to come as we are to this life and this practice, and that we don't have to measure up to someone else's standard in singing or in anything that we're doing. Not that we're immune to useful feedback and learning to evolve, but, you know, the Buddha said life is suffering. The other half of that is that the secondary suffering that we impose, there are the two daggers, mm-hmm. you know, the two kind of prongs of suffering. One of them is just life, birth, growth, decay, old age, death, like the suffering that's kind of inherent in life. My teacher used to talk about a tree grows, and through no fault of its own, a vine grows up around that tree and strangles it, and the tree dies. Did the tree do something wrong in its past life to deserve that? It's kind of just the suffering that's built into life itself. But the mm-hmm. second dagger is the poison that we inflict upon ourselves by judging the other suffering that we're encountering.
Yeah.
And that's where we can make a choice. That second suffering is optional.
Mm-hmm.
And singing is a beautiful opportunity to practice that, because there may be suffering involved in the practice itself. Like, I don't love my voice or myself right now very much in this moment, and yet I can just be with that like a crying child, you know?
Mm.
I'm not going to add to the child's suffering by like saying, we shouldn't do that right now. We're in the middle yeah. of dinner at a fancy restaurant, you know, like I'm going to pile on to your suffering. Like in the yeah. imperfect art of parenting, you start to learn like to just receive the suffering or the joy of what's given right now and to not impose on top of that. And singing just allows us to embody that practice.
Yeah, I think it is very part of kind of like our society and the structures around us that you sing if you have a good voice and if you do right. it well, and it's kind of built into like auditions and
right.
and in our culture competition, yeah, and the people in our culture that become singers are the one that do it well, and then, you know, there's even like a, like you joke about the people that don't have a good voice. And I really loved that you disconnected that. I also have noticed in the past that how connected we feel to people who do music. This is kind of related and unrelated, because like when mm-hmm. you ask somebody like, who do you want mm-hmm. to, if you could have dinner with anybody mm-hmm. living or dead, mm-hmm. doesn't matter where mm-hmm. they are in the world, who would you choose? I noticed that many times people choose musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought about it, I realized that when somebody sings and when you connect to mm-hmm. somebody who's singing mm-hmm. and the words that they use, it's a connection. You feel like in a way they're touching your soul.
Yeah.
Like they understand you on such a deep level
yeah.
that you feel connected to them no matter if you've never met them
yeah.
ever in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's one of the gifts of music, and I think that's incredible that you get to do this as your
yeah.
you know, your vocation, your profession, yeah. and your way of life.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to go back with you, because I know that even before being a monk,
mm-hmm.
you were in the music industry, right?
Yeah.
Doing very different kind of music. And then as I read you, you thought that you had to give up that life in mm. order to become a spiritual person, and you became a monk.
Mm.
And then maybe you can tell us about kind of returning to music after mm. that, and what shift you had mm. to make in yourself in order to kind of bridge those two mm. worlds.
It's amazing. As you were just saying that, I just had this vision of, it was like, literally, I dropped my drums, which at that time when I was a kid in college and when I first was moving into the monastery, it was like a drum set, like a gorgeous Sonar drum set, which was like my dream. You know, I had these gorgeous drums, and I've been playing drums since I was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was all I could think or talk about. And my parents were just so stunned and so shocked when I said, I'm done with music. And I let go of those drums, and I imagined them kind of falling through space. But then a few years later, they fell right back into my hands, and that drum set transformed into a whole other kind of drum. You could say it was kind of an evolutionary transformation, if not upgrade. And I then started playing the tablas, which are the Indian hand drums. If you listen mm-hmm. to someone like Ravi Shankar, you would hear the sound of the Indian tablas, which are considered to be kind of like the supreme like percussion instrument, one of the supreme percussion instruments on the planet. And as we've all experienced, like sometimes letting go is one of the most powerful ways to have that thing that we think we lost or released come back to us in a whole new evolved form. Mm. Because the reason for me that I let go of music was because the thing that had drawn me to it in the first place was what you just described so beautifully a minute ago, which is that sense of connection and speaking directly to our one another's souls. And I found myself feeling that as a musician with my bandmates as we're playing like jazz in smoky clubs, you know, and that kind of thing. I was in this, like, I call it my jazz communion. I felt this sense of like spirituality and the sacred there. And yet I looked around the room and I was like, I don't think everybody's feeling this. Mm. And that was, it broke my heart. And I felt like when I first encountered chanting and mantra, I was like, this sounds like a very different kind of music. And it isn't necessarily, at least at that time, it was very traditional and predictable. It wasn't musically that evolved to my ears, and yet it was overflowing with that sense of speaking to my soul. Mm. And I was like, I don't need those drums anymore. I'm getting the essence of it here. And yet in the act of letting go of that old way of accessing it, it came back to me in this new form. Well, then the music became a new expression of that initial contact, that essential contact with the soulful energy of music through chanting. Mm. So, transformation.
Wow. Beautiful. So it was really about connecting to the essence of the music, and through that finding your way back to what you were naturally drawn to as a young child.
There's a total through line, and in a way, I think the way I understand it now is the thing that drew me to music for my own healing, for my own fulfillment, which in the beginning felt kind of isolated and cabined off from the rest of the world. Like I had my own musical life and it was this thing, and maybe I shared it with a few people in the band. And that transformed into a new form of music where everybody could come into that experience through the mantra and through this ancient art of call and response chanting. Everybody joins the band. Everybody gets into the nectar that is music, whether or not they play an instrument, whether or not they think they can sing, whether or not they just totally a come as you are experience. And it's amazing because it just kind of like inverted the whole thing and just opened it and expanded it out so the world could join the band, essentially.
Yeah, I think we need more of those spaces.
Yeah.
In society and culture and in just our, you know, our everyday surroundings, mm-hmm. because so many of the places and mindsets are so far away from come as you are. It's the opposite. It's like you can only come if you're a certain type of person. Like in LA, there's so many different like members clubs. And it's really built around this feeling of how can we separate ourselves?
Yeah.
In order, like this may be harsh to say, but in order to kind of feed our egos.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And that's like a short term, it's like a drug. It's like a short term hit. It's like a like, you know, it does predictably give you that little endorphin hit, but it's, in my experience, not the long-lasting, sustainable way to feed something that we all not only crave but deserve. I heard Alan Watts say this thing, you know, like, how do we know what we want? You know, like, how do we go about finding out what we want, you know, and that process of inquiry? What is it we really want? What is it we're really seeking? And he said, when it comes down to it, you don't know what you want. Mm. And you think about it, you don't really know what you want. Like, you're yearning for this thing, and maybe it includes these elements. And so you chase those things. But when it comes down to it, you get that thing and it wasn't there. Like, how do you know what you really want? He said, there's two reasons why you don't know what you want. And the one that's relevant here is, you don't know what you want because you already have it. Because you are it.
Yeah.
And that experience of oneness, any way we can get to it, and one really powerful way is through chanting, is the most satisfying thing that's available. And it cuts through all the rest of it, that those sort of like temporary short-term fixes that we're all like, there's no way around those systems. It's sort of, in a way, it's kind of what we're made of and what the culture is sort of affirming day and night. Mm-hmm. But it's beautiful that we live in a time where people like you and this community are tuning in and waking up to the possibility of a more sustainable way of living in connection, instead of seeking, like, hopping lily pad to lily pad of short-term fix, you know?
Definitely. I think that there's definitely a shift going on. Mm. You can see it also, like, in the language on social media, that it's really becoming about not polishing a version and curating a version of yourself, but being the most authentic version of yourself online. And I think I've thought about this before. I think it's because people are really tired of not being good enough.
It's like so exhausting.
Yeah.
It's so exhausting to hold up that curated artifice.
Yeah. And you're like, doesn't matter how much you try. Doesn't matter how, like, what diet you do, what clothes you get, like all of the external things. You're always like falling short of the ideal, and the language around it, or the mindset even around it, has really been shifting lately to including more versions, because it used to be like, there's only one way that you're right. And right. Everything outside of that is wrong.
Yeah.
And it's becoming a lot more inclusive. Like, you see it in campaigns and in, you know, clothing companies, yeah, and just with the language that's going on online. So there is a lot of change happening.
Yeah. I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah. Even my daughter, who is just turned 17, like, she wrote this report for school, and just talking about the pitfalls of social media, and that the stress of holding up this curated version of ourselves. And it's so interesting that we're kind of externalizing this internal process that we're doing day in and day out.
Right.
Like, so we can see it out there on the socials, and then maybe we can have a little reflection and be like, I'm doing that all the time, even if I'm not putting it out there on social media. It's like we're kind of dramatizing our need to be good just as we are, and to be loved and received just as we are. And that love and acceptance comes first and foremost from us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the chanting sort of entrains that ability to more and more find that place of acceptance.
Hey, I'm quickly interrupting the episode to extend an invitation. If you are interested in deepening into any of the subjects we talk about on the podcast, we offer many different experiences on our beautiful grounds here in Baja, Mexico. From 9-day modules such as sound healing and yoga nidra, to breath and meditation, as well as 200 or 300 hour yoga teacher trainings, and many different shorter retreats. Check out our website, yandara.com, to see all the information about the different experiences. Let's get back to the episode.
I would love to speak with you also about your breath work. And we kind of spoke about this in preparation for the conversation about kind of ways to enhance our prana, our energy. So maybe you can explain what is prana and the different tools and ways that you enhance it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the insight for me is that there's this infinite reservoir of vital energy. Some systems call it chi, others call it prana. It's life force. It's our like joie de vivre. It's our like, lust for life. It's our vitality. And it's also what is keeping our bodies healthy and functioning. And in its fully arisen, awakened, unobstructed state, it is our awakening. It's our samadhi. It's our union. It's all the same energy, which is why, you know, certain systems prescribe things like celibacy or brahmachari or restraint, you know, because sexual energy is life energy, is spiritual energy. And we're living in a time where we're just like with mantra and the practice of chanting, there's all this interesting research about how we can cultivate these energies from an evidence-based perspective. And they can look in the laboratories and see like, well, actually, when you do breathing, certain breathing patterns, it has very specific effects. And the yogis were tuned into this in a very organic way in the laboratories of their own bodies without the benefit of fMRI or heart rate variability monitors or any of these things that we're using now. But the message overall for me is that there are so many amazing tools out there to connect us to this infinite reservoir of life energy. And it's sort of, I think, that conversation we were having earlier about how there's this inverse relationship between the flow of intuition, in this case, the flow of prana or vitality or life energy or grace, and on the other hand, the limiting artificial construct of our curated realities.
Definitely.
And it's the stories we're telling ourselves. It's the habits. We're talking about here breaking the habit of being ourselves and finding out more and more what's true through a direct experience rather than a persisting story or belief. And so there are breathwork practices out there. Some of my favorite include things like Wim Hof method, which is a breath retention practice that kind of harkens back to this Buddhist practice called the inner fire breath or Tummo. That's a series of 30 circular breaths, around 30 diaphragmatic breaths flowing into a breath retention for as long as possible. The benefits of that are epic to our immune system, to our mood, to our vitality, to our lung capacity, to our ability to resist illness and that sort of thing. And another one is called the breath of life, which is the practice that we shared this morning. It comes from also from Tibet, and it's a series of 9 pranayamas kind of alchemically, synergistically linked together to deliver a full body, all the organ meridian systems, balance, benefit, and inspiration to bring us to a state of heightened vitality, immunity, and awareness. You know, ultimately to me, you can't talk to a hungry person about spirit. The body has its needs. You know, in yoga, they talk about the 5 kleshas, I think is what it is, but there or these kind of, or the 5 kind of bodies, you know, I don't hold me to that. The koshas. Sorry. And the idea is that, yeah, it's all one. Yeah, it's all reality. It's all the divine. And yet the reality of the physical level is different and has its own sort of rules and dynamics versus the reality of the mental body, you know, versus the reality of the bliss body. Mm-hmm. If things are out of balance in the physical body, we're going to have a much more challenging time finding clarity and balance in the mental body.
Yeah, definitely. There's a base that has to be there in order for us to go to the more subtle layers.
And so the reason I love the pranic practices so much, another way of talking about them is Kriya Yoga, the yoga of energy. And so it's a way of getting those foundational layers in place because the breath speaks a language that the body understands.
Right.
If you start breathing, your body's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, you're suddenly like, you're starting to get into fight or flight versus if you do like what they call box breath, which is like if you do this with us now, like if you do like a slow 5 or 6 count inhale through the nose, followed by a slow 5 or 6 count exhale. And you continue to do that as I'm speaking, you start to notice through no other changes, through no other influence, you start to notice all the sand starts to settle. These are bottom-up practices versus top-down, where we're like trying to think our way into balance or think our way into freedom. These are bottom-up. You get the foundation into alignment. And the prana is it's a subtle tool, but it's less subtle than something like mindfulness, you know, or contemplation.
Yeah, if you're feeling in your head and like stressed, to tell somebody to sit down and focus on their breath, it might be really hard.
Yeah.
Or just like, you know, sit down and don't think. It could seem impossible in that moment. So starting from the physical, what you can actually control, like the breath, is a brilliant way to start.
Because the idea of Kriya, as I understand it, is the yoga of energy and action. And so you're not just sitting there and breathing as you would normally breathe. You're breathing, you're moving the energy in a specific way. You're taking an action by following a certain breathing rhythm with a very particular effect.
Yeah.
And most, if we're not conscious or we haven't done these kind of practices, our breathing might be a maleficent effect rather than a beneficent effect. It might be causing us less energy, more, you know, kind of dis-ease in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So the pranayama practices that I share, which I include on my website, ikarishmusic.com. It's just a free download. The Breath of Life practice is something we can do in 10 or 15 minutes a day. It's a great way to build that foundation because we're all dealing with, you know, the sort of like karmic package that we're born with. We're all dealing with the struggles and the limitations and the challenges. That's part of the evolutionary process. It's not a flaw, it's a feature.
Right.
And yet our ability to make that choice about that second dagger of the optional suffering is much more online, much more accessible to us if our foundation is pranically aligned.
Yeah, I find that that's really a great place to start because it's not a mistake that the philosophy of yoga, let's say, has the physical practice as the conduit, the place that you start to become more settled within yourself in order to allow the different practices. Yeah. So I think anything that starts with kind of regulating your body, whether it's physical movement or breath practices that are intentional or intentionally designed to create a certain effect on us. And you can't deny that the effect is meaningful. Anybody who has ever tried Wim Hof breathing, you feel it immediately, you feel it physically and also mentally, the effect of it on you. So I think that's a great, interesting way to bring or to explain how we can start to settle ourselves in order to reach the subtle layers of our existence, like the koshas that you you mentioned.
Exactly.
I would love to ask you about kind of your personal practice and where you are right now. What is something that you're working on, kind of biohacking, the word that you brought up before, within your own self?
Well, I have like a daily routine that I think is pretty extreme, but I tell myself that it should be because I teach these things. So it's just R&D, research and development. But I'm doing every day, I'm kind of bookending my day with mantra practice and time in front of my altar with like mantra meditation, puja, which is like offerings and connecting to the divine through action, through offerings. I'm bookending that around a whole series of biohacking tools, the nine healing breaths, which again, or the breath of life, which is on my website. Something called the five Tibetans, or the five rites of rejuvenation, which is another Tibetan yogic practice aimed at rejuvenation and raising the prana, but it's more like full body movement. And then I also do Wim Hof method, which is this circular breathing with long breath holds. I'm also doing cold exposure as like one of the most amazing resources for vitality, wellness, mood enhancement. And I have an ice bath at home, and I'm doing at least a couple times a day, I'm doing an ice bath. And
wow.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, the thing that I love about all the practices that I do, they're free. They're as near as our next breath. And like, I don't own like a fancy ice tub. I have a bathtub that I keep filled with water, and then have these giant ice cubes. I have like six or eight trays of these giant 1-cup ice cubes, and I fill it up, and the water's not like freezing cold. I aspire to have like a properly cold tub, but it's cold enough. And I, to make up for the fact that it's not quite down to the depths of, you know, like the polar regions, I stay in a little longer. And I do that a couple of times a day. But that's all free. And like, we can, like right now, when this podcast is done, we can walk into our bathrooms and jump in the shower. And if we need a reset, if we need to kind of restart in the midst of our day, which we always do at some point, a minute, 2 minutes of cold water, especially on the back of the neck, directly over the whole body, of course, is great too, or a plunge in a cold pool is great. It's the most kind of like easy, economical, do-it-yourself biohack that I've ever found. And you couple that with the balancing effects of breath work. The cold plunge is about sort of like raising dopamine levels to kind of give you that can-do motivation energy. The breath work, at least the breath of life practice, is about balancing and then also raising the energy. The five Tibetans is about balancing and raising the energy throughout the whole body as well. So between those two things, you kind of have all bases covered. And then the mantra practice is about working with, you know, the subtler energies of intention and these divine archetypes that flow through this ancient yogic system.
Beautiful. Wow. Sounds impressive.
It's my job.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I feel like you can't really be a teacher if you don't practice these things yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, when the going gets strange, the strange turn pro, I think is the quote. But like, these things that I've always been naturally inclined towards. And it was funny to have an astrologer read this in my chart years and years ago, talking about how these, he didn't use the word, but these kind of biohacking tools, he was like, oh, you're going to have a really long life. You're going to be like really healthy and really vital. And as long as you do these practices. And at the time I had been doing yoga and all that. And I was like, yeah, I get it. But then the pandemic really kind of put an exclamation point on it. And when the pandemic started, I felt like my authentic response was, I want to strip away all the non-essentials and get right to the thing that's going to give us a palpable sense of wellness, of connection, and enhance our immunity to boot. And so I really leaned into that for myself and for my Sangha, my community. And it seems to be catching on everywhere. You know, it's, the world is now full of people who know about these practices. And what I love is that it's kind of stripping away what used to be kind of tangled up in dogma and philosophy. You can believe anything you want. You can be a Hindu, you can be a Catholic, you can be a Wiccan. Like, it's not beautiful. Whatever story feels good. To me, like, ultimately it comes down to right here, right now, what's your experience?
Yeah. Breath and energy.
Breath and energy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Direct. Direct experience.
Beautiful. We spoke about this lens that we kind of put on ourselves with the perception of who we are. What is a layer of yourself that is, might be a little difficult for you to remove, something that you keep returning to?
Oh my gosh. Gosh, there's so much, you know. It's like if I focused on just those, it was like, it'd be like if there was this like beautiful painting and in the corner there's like this trash can like overflowing with like flies and rotten bananas and like you know, like I could zoom in
what
on that
image.
And just, yeah, it is, right? But that's us. That's us with our spotlight consciousness, you know. For me, one of the places where it's most like palpable is around this vulnerable act of like, and this might seem ironic to say doing what I do, but the act of creation, of artistic creation, the act of singing, still feels vulnerable in the creation phase where the song is first coming through. That moment of facing the blank canvas or computer screen, the inception piece of it is so vulnerable. And those voices of not enough, you don't know what the fuck you're doing, you're not a proper singer, like you're not, you don't have anything worthwhile to say, all that stuff, all those stories, you know, the pain body speaks very loudly there. Because the soul doesn't yet have evidence. Like a song comes through, a beautiful song or a beautiful act or a beautiful idea, or we manifest something. We're like, there it is. I can, you can point to it. And there's comfort and security, seeming security in that. But in that vulnerable moment of the void, you're open to criticism by the voices that are saying like, see, you got nothing to show, you got nothing to say. And that is hard work. And for me, like the tool that seems to be most effective is to step into that void space without needing to prove something, but in a space of play, playfulness.
Yeah.
And just let the experience itself be enough. And then the funny punchline is, from the play emerges product.
Yeah.
But no product if there's no play.
Definitely.
Yeah.
That goes back to what we said before, like letting go of like the structure of it and just allowing it to be fun. I love that you said play, because it really, it comes from what is fun for you. Like I find that our path reveals itself to us through what brings us joy.
Yeah.
And when we allow ourselves to kind of let go of like needing to be a grown up and having everything figured out and being serious about things, even about the yoga practice, like when I see people too serious in the face,
yeah,
you know that there's something is not
yeah.
working.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true.
And I also heard somebody say this really beautifully, like it's about letting go of, there are many different ways that an expression can manifest. Like it doesn't have to be a world hit, let's say if we're talking about music, for it to have an effect on many different people. Mm. And somebody said it in this way, like, you can choose any artist that you admire, let's say Paul Simon that you mentened. Imagine Paul Simon said to himself, there are so many musicians already. Who needs another musician and more songs? And then the world wouldn't have Paul Simon's creations.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine a world without his music.
It's so true. And then the thing you were saying earlier about, like, you know, we see that people with like amazing voices are the ones who are allowed to sing. But if you think about that thing you also said about how we connect on the soul level with musicians, but this is also just a metaphor for the voice of our being, the voice of our
Definitely.
Soul that comes through. It's not music.
Definitely.
Music is one, it's just a metaphor.
Yeah.
But we share the voice of our soul, the song of our lives, you know.
Definitely.
And you think about the variety and the diversity of the voices that are out there, from like Gaga to Dylan. I mean, it's like, it's not an aesthetic thing that makes the voice have this like world transforming power.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's about the realness
of
the voice.
The realness.
And you're so right in that it can be applied, or it is applied, to any field that you choose. It's
yeah.
not just about being a musician.
Mm-hmm.
It's any place that you allow yourself to express your real voice.
Mm-hmm.
Without the conditioning of what it's supposed to look like, of mm-hmm. this is a successful path to take and this is not a successful path to take.
Yeah.
I find that even like if your true calling is telling you to make candles and that's your true real voice in mm-hmm. the world,
mm-hmm.
that will have a much bigger effect mm-hmm. on the world mm-hmm. around you
mm-hmm.
than you choosing to go and be a lawyer
yeah.
because that is what is considered successful.
Well, the question to ask is, like, if we're deciding on like our path, like what would you do if money were no object?
Mm.
What would you choose to do if money were no object?
But we're conditioned, because how many times have we heard that musicians don't make money
mm-hmm.
or that actors, you know, you can't, like it's rare to become successful as an actor. And
mm-hmm.
that is true in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when you're really following the calling of your inner
mm-hmm.
truth,
mm-hmm.
the universe supports you in being able to do that.
100%. It's exactly right. And there's something too, there's this other little nuance in that, which is that like you have this vision, like I want to be an actor, I want to be a singer. And so you take that leap, money's no object, I'm going to do it. And you get a gig as a voiceover artist and you make, like, I know somebody who was like the voice of Jenny Craig, you know, our friend Katie Wise was like the voice of Jenny Craig, and she made a mint, you know, like doing the voice of Jenny Craig. She also is like an artist, like a proper like songwriter and an amazing artist. That probably wasn't in her career plan, like to be the voice of Jenny Craig. And yet that set her up to give her space, time, and resources to become this artist that she took that step towards.
Yeah.
I mean, you wanted to be an actor and then you became, you know, a school teacher and you earned your bread and butter because you cultivated this presence, you know, in yourself by studying acting. You know, it's just, it liberates energy. Playing it safe and playing it like secure, as you said, like it constricts energy. The energy keeps getting smaller and smaller versus that infinite flow of energy that we want to connect with.
Yeah. And that voice is always there. Like, it doesn't matter how much you try to quiet it down and push it down and aside, it's always going to be there. And the further away you go from it, the more suffering you experience. I'm almost certain of that. I'm pretty certain.
The voice of the soul saying, please come here. This is your destiny.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes.
This is exactly what I experienced with my journey to singing. And it was this quote that I saw, and it was embodied in my life just so palpably. And the quote is ascribed to Jesus. And it was, if you do not bring forth what's within you will destroy you.
Wow.
If you do bring forth what's within you will save you. And I put that up on my wall because I was trying to tell myself, like, look, this doesn't feel secure. This doesn't feel safe. This doesn't feel reasonable. But here are the facts. Like, you know, at a soul level, that you are yearning to do this. Like, this is the difference between, like, that girl's hot. Like, and I, you know, like it's like a temporary, momentary flash of desire versus like something that's like, I love this person. This person is a soulmate. This is like a life partner. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something, there's a kind of desire that speaks to you at that soul level. And we know what's what there, you know, and this thing had been speaking to me like that. And at a certain point, like Anais Nin said, like, the pain of remaining closed in a tight bud became greater than the threat of daring to open.
Yeah.
And it was that, you know, and that's what it is for us day by day. That's, we make those leaps on the microcosmic and macrocosmic levels, you know, every day. And I think it gets easier for us when there's that kind of Maharishi effect of the collective, where more and more of us are saying, okay, we thought satisfaction was in our siloed little exclusive members only clubs, but actually there's this field, this connective field where the real juice is flowing.
Yeah.
And the more of us who are flowing in it, maybe the easier it is for the rest of us to tune into it, and and for us all to stay tuned into it.
100%. Like when studies have been done on how movements have started, it really started from one person. And then the more people started to resonate with the vision of that person, the stronger the movement became. Right. And that it starts with kind of like the, what was the word that they used? The early adopters. And then I forget the other terms, but like there's different levels of society that that the more people go into it and start to act that way, the more people are attracted
to
it.
The momentum.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's even like a mathematical formula for that Maharishi effect, where they've done these studies where they have meditators going into war zones, and how many meditators it takes to sit together based in relation to the population to measurably, predictably begin to influence the occurrence of violence and crime.
And they saw a direct effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been, I think it's like 15 official scientific peer-reviewed studies done on this.
Wow. Incredible. To wrap up the conversation, this incredibly inspiring conversation, I'll ask you the closing curiosity questions that I always ask. How do you experience spirituality?
wow, it's just the mystery, ever unfolding mystery, you know, kind of moment to moment of revelation. You know, like, I guess I might have answered that question differently as like a 21-year-old monk or something. But to me, spirituality is something that can be lived and experienced and shared like one candle lighting another. But it's only ever as real as that direct experience. Mm. And I know that it's something that is, that blossoms when we share it.
Yeah.
You know, like this love virus or something. It's like, it's like the soul pandemic of probably too soon for that metaphor, but yeah, and I feel like I'm at a place in my life where, there's just so much evolution around that, and in the midst of the vulnerability and uncertainty that is life, there's this kind of rising sense of this innate, direct experience and connection with that revelation that is spirituality, you know, something that's so much bigger than us, and yet like fills and inspires and guides us. That feels like it's dancing with that, saying yes to that, even in our blindness, as you were saying, you know, not being able to understand it is spirituality for me. Mm. And it's a very vulnerable, and yet it's like you're surfing on the edge of this wave, you know?
Yeah, beautiful. Mm-hmm. What is something you didn't think you could do and you did?
Well, I didn't think I could sing. I didn't think I could be a father. Mm. No, I didn't think I could be a teacher. I didn't think I could be an author. You know, I feel like we're constantly kind of proving that doubting voice wrong, you know, and leaping into possibility, because we hear that heart calling, or maybe it's, you know, an invitation that comes through an email, you know. Mm. I didn't, like, in my case, the music was something that was, has always kind of called me from the inside, but like when I was invited to write a book, even though I was an English major in college, I majored in creative writing. Like, I kind of felt like that was my past, and I didn't intend to pursue it, but I got invited to write a book, and I said yes. And then I said, oh shit, now I have to write a book. And I spent a few months being like, I don't know if I can do this. And then I found my process. And what I've learned is that we really can do anything we feel called to do. All we have to do is quiet that judging voice as we take these steps towards that intention, and figure out what our process looks. And for me, that figuring out was helped by figuring out what's his process, what's her process. Mm. I see this works for me, that does not work for me, and just figuring it out. In the end, my process looked like me sitting on one of those core balls in front of a tiny little side table desk with an iPad and a Bluetooth keyboard, so that the computer screen was this big instead of this big, because this big feels too fucking scary.
Oh,
like I needed the technology to be like really small. Like, if it's not really there, there's no pressure. I'm just like flowing, and
you're kind of
that
fooling worked. Yourself.
I was playing. I wrote that book.
Wow.
And when it came through, I wrote the whole book in 3 months.
Wow. Isn't that interesting, though, how the different steps in our paths can seem as though they're unrelated,
right?
And then they show up again in a different form later on.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, there are movies that play with that idea. They kind of play with it. And sometimes it's like, it ends up being like an M. Night Shyamalan kind of thing. Like, I know what you're talking about, but yeah. But in real life, it's so much more like amazing and elegant and refined and exactly.
Feel like more my generation gets a lot of criticism for like jumping around from thing to thing. Mm-hmm. But a classic example that is given here is Steve Jobs and his process that in college, he by chance walked into a calligraphy class, and that kind of became the whole background of why aesthetics were so important to him. And he had like all the fonts and all of that. And, it kind of is like the classic example of something that is seemingly unrelated, gives another like depth to your gift.
100%. I love that. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Last question.
Yeah.
What are you curious about right now?
At this very moment, I'm sitting on the Baja Peninsula at the beginning of this 6-day retreat. And it's so interesting to come into it, not from a place of like, here's my syllabus, here's my plan, although I have a plan, but it's more like a blueprint. And I'm leaning into this idea of the beautiful humans who gathered here for this retreat and I are co-creating something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of leaning in with curiosity to like, not like, hey, I'm the retreat leader and this is what we're up to today, guys, and get with the program, but like, how can I hold space for what we're co-creating, which means I'm observing and listening to everyone. And like, we have somebody who is a plant medicine guide. We have somebody who is an avid bird watcher who's educating us all about the different species of birds that are here, and someone who's a yoga teacher and a school teacher, and like leaning into this possibility that life, just as it is, imperfectly perfect, is exactly the ingredients that we need, like Steve Jobs' calligraphy class, to bring forth the perfect iMac of our existence, you know, but our like, what is the operating system of this day, of this life, of this incarnation? And I'm like experiencing that kind of on a microcosmic level with the humans in this retreat. And it feels really good to have this dance, this interplay, this connectedness. And like somebody said after the class this morning, she was like, I already love everybody in this group, and we've just been here one day.
Yeah, so the heart opens immediately in these kind of settings. Mm-hmm. So that's incredible.
Yeah, I love that.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Thank you for making space for this to come through for us and for everyone watching. And for just, you know, intercepting me.
I caught you right when you arrived.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
it's
good. I wanted to make sure this happens because I knew it was going to be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Yael.
How can people stay connected with you?
So girishmusic.com is the main website. We have amazing offerings. We have online. Harmonium Evolution is an opportunity to play this incredible instrument called the harmonium, which really is like your best friend in this journey of loving yourself through your singing voice and learning all these amazing mantras and chants. I'm doing in-person retreats like this Prana Rising immersion here in Baja. I have several other international retreats coming up in the Azores and in the Bahamas and back here again. And then just in-person touring all around the U.S., my book, Music and Mantras, is just like a living kind of ally and companion in this journey of coming home to ourselves through the practice of singing and chanting. And it comes with audio and music to support that journey. And it really is just a great companion on that quest.
Amazing. Girish, thank you so much.
It was
lovely.
Now, after this time to nurture your mind and your spirit, we invite you to take a moment to consider others. A kind wish might come to mind. Know that what we learn becomes more valuable when we apply it and share it with others. So share this episode on Instagram stories, tag Yandara and I, or share with a loved one so that more people can benefit from it. Our hope is that the search will lead you home to who you already are, to what was always there. We'll be back next week with more inspiration, honest conversation, and insight into the energetic world around us. Thank you for listening and watching.